When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There were three ravens sat on a tree. Down a down, hey, down a down. They were as black as they might be with a down. One of them said to his mate, "Where shall we our breakfast take? With a down, derry, 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 down, down."
Hello and welcome to an all-new episode of the Three Ravens Bestiary, a bonus series all about mythical monsters, legendary creatures, and things that go bump in the night. I'm Martin.
I'm Eleanor.
And in this episode, we're talking about dragons and answering some fearsome questions, such as, how did the mongoose play a role in our understanding of dragons? Quite how long should a dragon really be? And what the heck are dragons meant to symbolise when we encounter them in folktales?
Well, this is extremely exciting. And based on all the research you've been doing and this slightly mad work fugue you entered in preparation for this recording, would it be fair to say you've gone in pretty hard on this one?
I have, because dragons, Eleanor. They're kind of the big daddy of mythical creatures.
True.
So yeah, this is going to be a daddy of an episode of Three Ravens Bestiary. Still, to start us off, and I realise this is an incredibly difficult question to answer, but when you think about dragons, what are the first things that pop into your head?
Well, this is a huge topic because I think dragons mean many different things to many different people across all sorts of cultures. Mm. There's famous pop culture dragons like those from the George R. R. Martin book series and TV shows, Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, plus the Smaug from J.R.R. Tolkien's Middle Earth books.
Yeah, they are a mainstay of fantasy fiction, aren't they?
Yes, fantasy books and films and TV series. Plus, they have important roles in folklore and literature, such as in Beowulf,
yeah,
or the story of St. George and the Dragon, which we were talking about last week. Plus, they also crop up in mythology all over the world. But maybe the classic idea of a dragon for me is probably a medieval one, which is a fire-breathing, winged monster that very often needs vanquishing.
And that alone is very interesting because the medieval model of a dragon is just one version of what dragons even look like.
Well, in England, we draw distinctions between your classic dragons with four legs and wings and the power to breathe fire or poison, and wyverns, which in my mind have just the two front legs and a snaky tail.
Sure.
And then you have worms, which maybe have wings but no legs. And I must say, I do not like worm-type dragons very much at all.
No.
The lack of legs is creepy.
You don't like snaky things in general, do you?
I do not, know. But also, you get loads of different types of dragons in popular culture, including those associated with different primal elements.
Yes.
So growing out of humorism and medieval medicine, you might have fire, water, earth, and air dragons. And, you know, they're a big feature of RPGs like Dungeons & Dragons and video games like Skyrim. But by that same measure, you get lucky dragons from China, the biblical water dragon, the Leviathan. I mean, it is a massive area of scholarship.
It is. And disclaimer, we won't be covering the whole topic area in detail today, as this episode would be 3 days long.
Generally, though, to try and answer your original question, I'd say that when I think about dragons, I have positive thoughts. Good. I like them a lot.
Right.
Apart from worms. I think everyone likes dragons, don't they? They're pretty much the king of mythical creatures.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that in the hierarchy of mythical creatures, the dragon sort of occupies the top spot. And also, it's worth saying that I was very nervous about writing this episode, but was encouraged by our lovely listeners on social media.
Yes, Martin put a call out during series 3 about which folkloric creatures people wanted episodes about moving forwards. And dragons were the number one choice.
They were. And as mentioned, there's no way I could hope to discuss every facet of dragons and dragon lore here. But as with previous episodes of the Three Ravens Bestiary more generally, I'm going to offer a bit of an overview and a history of the idea of dragons, and maybe we'll return to the topic at a future date.
Outstanding.
So, my way into this discussion was to scrabble right back to the beginning, to the very first references to dragons in art and literature, seeing what I could find. And in terms of the term itself, the word dragon comes to England, along with lots of other outstanding Norman innovations, via the French word dragon, meaning huge serpent.
Uh-huh. And when you say outstanding Norman innovations,
yes,
I presume you mean the Norman yoke of oppression foisted onto the Anglo-Saxon population by your dastardly forebears.
Well, I was thinking more of nice square castles and glorious architecture and an increasingly developed system of economic governance. But they did also bring quite a lot of death along with them too, didn't they?
As did every major invading force England has known. Still, the Normans were pretty hot on dragons, weren't they?
They were. And a lot of English folktales about dragons are explicitly linked to Norman lords and their families, as discussed on previous episodes. So there was definitely something in the Norman character that considered the dragon culturally significant, and it comes from several directions at once.
Does it now? That's intriguing.
Yeah, it is. And it's worth saying that the French word dragon, in turn, has its roots in ancient Greek and Latin, specifically the term draco, which wasn't necessarily used to refer to a mythical creature, but rather the word draco was used across the classical world describe any whacking great big serpent.
That's interesting. So does that mean that for the Greeks and Romans, dragons weren't necessarily flying creatures?
Most definitely not. In fact, there are even older words than draco, such as the Sanskrit word dros and the Indo-European root word durko, which are actually to do with sight and the eyes.
The eyes?
Yeah. So from what we can understand, the most ancient terms for dragons grow out of huge serpents and their eyes. And this leads into terms like derkomai in ancient Greek, meaning I see, with associations from that root term linked to bright eyes or bright sight and also sharp sight, which I think is very interesting.
It is, because from what you're saying, it seems that dragons have baked into their very earliest naming conventions in Europe this idea of perhaps seeing what other people can't see, first of all, but also sharp sight does have a tantalising link to concepts like the basilisk or the cockatrice.
Exactly right. The basilisk or cockatrice, which of course are famous for petrifying people, literally turning them to stone with their sight, if not their breath. And we've spoken a bit about this before, in that until, believe it or not, the 1960s and the development of Dungeons and Dragons, the role-playing game, basilisk and cockatrice were words for the same thing.
And we tend to think about them as kinds of chimera, don't we? Blending together parts of different animals.
Yeah.
So you've got bits of lion, bits of chicken, bits of serpent, sometimes bits of bat.
Yep, but first mentioned in the 14th century in the Wycliffe Bible as a substitute term for serpents, asps, and adders.
Oh, wow. So even then, a basilisk or a cockatrice was essentially a serpent.
Yep. And those ideas were embellished by the Elizabethans in particular, with the various lore about cockatrice or basilisk being the result of a chicken mating with a toad or some versions of interspecies breeding. And Wycliffe took his idea from a description in Pliny's Natural History, dating from about 79 AD, when Pliny describes how a mongoose is the natural enemy of the dragon.
Sorry, what? a mongoose.
Yep, it's a real tangle of mistranslations because Pliny is talking about snakes and crocodiles and trying to describe a mongoose and a trochilus, a bird with a symbiotic relationship with crocodiles. And that gets muddied up by 12th and 13th century natural philosophers and travellers writing about things they've seen or heard of. But at the root of it all, in essence, is the link between dragons and snakes or serpents.
When it comes to the cockatrice or the basilisk, the idea is that these horrible serpents basically have the power to turn people into stone.
And that, in turn, has a kind of logical association of people being so scared by the sight of huge serpents that they'd be frozen rigid, and also to other mythical creatures like the Gorgon Medusa with her head of snakes, who also turned people to stone.
Fascinating. And my mind is whirring away here, because even now in popular culture we have the idea of the fire-breathing dragon that scorches people into ash.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me there's something going on in our ideas of dragons from their earliest references through to today about turning flesh into inanimate matter, like stone, might be ash, but it's this notion that after being struck by a dragon you'll be changed or transformed from one thing into another.
Most definitely. And I think, again, if we think about this in a very simple and quite unromantic way, as a metaphor for being poisoned by a snake bite, we can imagine how, if someone's found having encountered a snake, having been injected with snake venom, they could very well have turned rigid because of the effects of the venom.
Of course.
And without anti-venom or a means of a cure, they would very much be transformed from one thing into another, from a living being of lovely warm flesh into a cold, lifeless entity who is, in essence, an object ready to be returned to the earth.
Wow, so straight away we've gone deep, haven't we? From 0 to 100 miles an hour, it feels like. Tons of interpretation and extrapolation. But from what you're saying, it seems like if we were trying to explain dragons away, we could basically say that they're seen as such terrifying creatures because we, as humans, have a sort of understandable, maybe evolutionary, fear of snakes.
Yeah, that is definitely one line of argument. And with that in mind, it makes sense that dragons are generally associated with places like the wilderness, with mountains. They live in deep, dark caves or deep, dark pools, haunted forests at the bottom of the sea. And historically, these are all places where snaky creatures were seen to dwell. And where, frankly, even now, if you're bitten by a poisonous serpent, you're a goner, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, as mentioned, I don't much like snakes at the best of times.
Yeah.
And I just happened to be looking this up the other day. I look things up about snakes sometimes just to keep an eye on what they're up to.
Yeah.
And just last year, well over 2 million people globally were bitten by poisonous snakes. And almost 10% of those people died.
What?
Plus, a surprising number of those who lived have still had to undergo amputations or experience permanent disabilities as a result. So snake bites remain a serious business.
And that's
Avoid snakes, everyone.
That's with modern science.
Yes.
Oh, that's pretty scary.
Snakes can be absolute jerks, Martin. Not all of them. I'm not being blanket snakeist here. I'm sure there are some that are very nice. But as a species, we have had enough experience over time to think, yep, I see you, snake, and you can absolutely categorically jog right on.
Or, well, you know, slither right on.
Yes, if they must, but ideally jogging would be better because I'm not a huge fan of the way they slither. Really gives me the creeps.
In which case, let's jog swiftly on ourselves back to the ways in which, right from our earliest recorded legends, we have a whole host of dragons pitching up in the public consciousness. Because, unlike some of the creatures we've spoken about on the Three Ravens bestiary before, the idea of dragons is about as ancient as anything in human culture.
I did wonder, because Greeks and Romans and snakes can't be the origins of everything we think about as dragons.
Oh, definitely not. Because in the modern day, we think about them as mythological, sure. But it must be said, they are a fairly universal mythological icon cropping up in more or less every human culture right from the first writing and art in each.
Which means no doubt that we're dipping back to ancient Mesopotamia and ancient Egypt. And I say that because, as discussed on previous episodes, we find the very first examples of human literature in those cultures.
Indeed we are, and indeed we do. And looking to ancient Mesopotamia first, which, geographically speaking, was in what's now modern-day Iraq, and where the very first human cities came into being, we get our first dragon of note, Muskzuzu, a hybrid demon creature whose name translates as the Red Snake.
Oh, the Red Snake. Mm. Cool name. But you said it's a hybrid demon.
It is. And this is where all of our chat about dragons just being serpents hits the skids straight away. Because although Muskzuzu was known as the Red Snake, he's got wings and other funky body parts, so he ain't just a snake.
So this winged snake is the first dragon we have written about in human civilization.
Yep, and much like the later chimera-type descriptions of a cockatrice or basilisk, he has a big snake's tongue and scales, but lion-like forearms, eagle-like back legs with talons, and his skin is also described as being covered in fish-like scales.
I love these ancient descriptions, because if you drew something based on that list, yes, you would end up with a very silly-looking monster.
Yeah, between all of that, a snake's head and tongue, lion and eagle-like legs with talons or claws covered with scales, well, in my mind, you've got something very close to our idea of a traditional-looking dragon.
Well, yes, if you combine those elements of the description together one way rather than the other. But I'm guessing old Muskzuzu didn't breathe fire.
No, he didn't. There are, it's worth saying, loads of statues and artistic representations of Muskzuzu from ancient Mesopotamia. And significantly, the ancient Babylonians named the constellation we call Hydra after Muskzuzu. So even back then, the Hydra constellation was associated with a whacking great hybrid snake monster.
That's super interesting and ties into ideas we've encountered before of Mesopotamian ideas being adapted by later civilizations, like the classical love goddess Aphrodite or Venus growing out of the ancient Mesopotamian goddess Inanna or Ishtar.
Indeed, and Adonis and the biblical Adam growing out of the Mesopotamian Adon and so on. And when it comes to Ishtar, actually, we spoke in our Easter special about the Ishtar Gate, this whacking great monument in ancient Babylon.
We did. A huge structure covered in lapis lazuli blue with icons of the main Babylonian or Mesopotamian deities repeated all over it.
Indeed, and call back to last week's Crystals episode on lapis lazuli. Anyway, on the Ishtar Gate, we have this repeated frieze on which Muskzuzu appears, representing his patron deity, Marduk.
Now, I can readily admit I don't know loads about ancient Mesopotamian deities, but to loop back for a second to something you mentioned a moment ago, you said that this dragon's name, Muskzuzu, means red snake or red serpent.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking about the colour associations of red, which maybe include love and passion, but which definitely include blood and violence and anger. Danger, of course, as per modern warning signs.
Yeah, and in fact, an alternate translation of Muskzuzu is fierce serpent or deadly serpent, or in some translations, splendid serpent.
Oh, I like that. Splendid serpent. It feels like, though, it's based on which newspaper's reporting.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So is he splendid serpent in the Daily Mail, but fierce serpent in the Guardian?
Yeah, well, still, the idea with Muskzuzu is he was originally ruled over by the ancient god of agriculture, Ning Ishzida, and was one of three dragons born from the three snaking rivers of Mesopotamia. Those are the two branches of the Tigris and the Euphrates.
So the landscape here becoming part of the national folklore, which is something very common across the world.
Indeed. Now, one of these dragons was Bashmu, the venomous snake. Another was Usungalu, the great snake. And then you have Muskzuzu, the red snake or fierce snake.
So why aren't Bashmu and Usungalu so famous?
Well, originally, all three were made by Tiamat, the goddess of the sea. But before long, during the rising of the new gods, which is very similar to Zeus's rebellion against the titan Cronus, Marduk, the sun god, slayed Tiamat, turning her ribs into the vault of the sky. Then Nergal, the god of death and kind of Hades or Pluto equivalent, slays Bashmu. And Marduk's son, Nabu, the god of wisdom and art, kind of the Mercury of the Mesopotamian pantheon, slays Usungalu.
But what of Muskzuzu?
Well, rather than killing Musk-Zuzu, Marduk subdues him and keeps him as a servant.
Oh, well, that's pretty awesome. That means, I guess, that the ancient Mesopotamian god of the sun had a dragon as a pet?
Yeah, pretty much. A pet, a servant, a mount at times. And all three of those primal dragons were also said to have had horns and to have been, and check this out for wild, 60 double miles long, so 120 miles long each.
Those are jolly big dragons, aren't they?
Yeah, they are very, very large dragons. And I suppose that makes sense if you think about them as representing those rivers. But still, we sometimes talk about dragons eating sheep and cattle in European folklore. And can you imagine how many cows and sheepy bars it would require to feed a 120-mile-long dragon?
It's a lot of sheepy bars.
A lot of sheepy bars. Anyway, so that's our earliest and most famous dragon, plus his dead siblings, R.I.P. Bashmu and Usumgalu.
And what about the Egyptians?
Well, not long after we get those very first Mesopotamian myths, which date from around 5,000 years ago, we get the ancient Egyptians describing Apep, the ancient Egyptian embodiment of chaos.
Oh, yes, you spoke a little bit about Apep back in the Three Ravens Vestry episode about demons. Mm. And if I remember rightly, he's sort of the primal force of darkness and disorder, with his opponent being Maat, the female primal force of light and justice.
Yeah, quite right. And Art of Apep, or Apep, predates writing about him. We have art of him from about 6,000 years ago, but he's only written about quite sparingly from about 4,000 years ago. And in terms of Apep and Maat, they're binary opposites, and Apep specifically is described as still being pretty big. He's meant to be 16 yards long, so intimidating against the scale of a human, capable of growing much larger when the need calls for it.
Well, 16 yards long feels manageable, certainly against a dragon that's 120 miles long.
Yeah, 16 yards is between 14 and 15 metres, and that feels like an appropriate size for a dragon. Not quite as long as blue whales, the largest animal in nature today, which are on average 24 metres long, but well over double the length of the African bush elephant, the world's largest land mammal.
But you said he could get larger.
Yeah, so Apep is described as having a head made of flint, which is suitably strange, and he was a bad luck deity. He's sort of the universal bogeyman of the earliest Egyptian myths, including the pyramid texts and the coffin texts. But he's supposed to live in the dark place just beyond sunrise and sunset, so he's always out of view, and it was believed he could lengthen out to encircle the world, squeezing it to cause earthquakes.
Well, that is much, much larger than 120 miles long.
Yeah, the circumference of the world is just shy of 25,000 miles. So if he stretched right the way round, he was a very big boy.
That's a lot of dragon. And I think I'm right in saying that it's from Apep that we get the rough idea of the serpent in the book of Genesis.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Genesis is a fascinating book of the Bible. If you've never read it, it folds in lots of myths from other cultures, including the flood narrative, which comes whole and entire from ancient Mesopotamia. And Apep is very much the kind of progenitor to the serpent in the Garden of Eden, this agent of freedom and chaos with whom Ra, the ancient Egyptian god of the sun, is often known to duel.
And with a deity like Apep, I'm always interested to know, did people worship him?
Ah, well.
I ask because we know in a lot of cases of even not very nice deities, people did things to appease or worship these dark forces. Were there, for example, ancient Egyptian snake or dragon cults dedicated to Apep? By which I mean, did ancient Egyptians go in for ideas like appeasing their version of the devil?
Well, no, actually, quite the opposite. Because unlike in ancient Mesopotamia or ancient Greece and Rome, where even bad gods were there to be appeased and weren't all bad, ancient Egyptians did not like Apep at all. In fact, they used to make models of Apep, often out of wax or other materials. Sometimes they would draw him. And then, to show how much they didn't like him, they would tear these works of art up. They'd spit on them, they'd stamp on them, normally using their left feet, which was seen as the bad foot. They'd stab them, they'd break them apart and ritually burn them.
What?
Yep. And so they'd make statues, art and icons, then ceremonially destroy them, normally while reciting spells and incantations to cast out bad luck, keep away chaos and show naughty Our Pep a jolly good lesson.
That is absolutely wonderful. I love the idea of making a statue of something you hate just to mutilate it and smash it to bits. Sounds incredibly cathartic.
Well, we do similar on occasions like Bonfire Night, don't
yes,
we?
Yes, true.
Yeah, especially around Sussex, where huge effigies of politicians or pop culture figures are made and ritually destroyed.
But I'm going to go out on a limb here, because unlike snakes, I have limbs to go out on.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And I'm going to say that the ancient Mesopotamian model of a dragon sounds to me much more dragony than Apep does. Specifically, when I think about dragons, I tend to think of wings, and it sounds like Apep didn't have any.
No, he didn't. He was just a serpent with magical chaos qualities. But I draw your attention to a great many other types of dragon that don't have wings.
Yes, I immediately realise that my diagnosis is showing bias because, for example, Chinese dragons.
Precisely. And while in Chinese folklore, dragons are generally thought of as lucky, there's actually a ton of examples in Eastern belief and mythological tradition where dragons are very unlucky and also don't have wings.
Well, I know that in Japanese folklore, you get loads and loads of flightless dragons known as Nion no Ryu, which are kami, so nature spirits.
Yeah, in Hindu mythology, you get the likes of Vritra, who's a demonic dragon who blocks rivers, creating droughts. And in Japanese folklore, similarly, like most eastern dragons, Nihon no Ryu are primarily water demons or water deities, and there's tons and tons of legends associated with them.
But would it be fair to say that the root of most of these myths is likely to be China?
Yeah.
Because Chinese mythology and folk belief did spread throughout much of Asia and became kind of the basis of a lot of other cultural systems, certainly in the case of Japan and Korea.
Yeah, no doubt at all. The oldest records we have of dragons in the Far East come from China. And to get a sense of how old Chinese dragons are, if you think back to ancient Mesopotamia, the Musk-Susu legends and art we have are at the most 6,000 years old, which is very old. But the oldest evidence of Chinese dragon carvings dates back over 8,000 years. So it may well be that Chinese dragons are the oldest dragons of all.
But we don't have any writing about them from that period.
No writing at all until much, much later, because, call back to our vellum and parchment making dying arts episodes, paper rots. So if there were records from those times, they're long gone. Still, the very early dragon carvings we have in China are sometimes known as pig dragons.
Pig dragons? What? Are they another form of chimera? Pig and dragon hybrid?
Well, rather than the more familiar long, which are the twisty, twirly dragons you see in Chinese New Year parades and much of Chinese art, pig dragons are strange-looking things. Modern archaeology tends to associate them with fetal imagery, and these early jade sculptures we have of them show them as coiled. And that then fed into particular swirly letters in the Chinese language, as well as early dragon amulets and other coiled jewellery.
But a bit like in Japan, dragons in China were long associated with the power of imperial families, weren't they?
They were. Like in Japan, there's a belief in China that all the powerful emperors contained a bit of dragon blood in their ancestry. But one incredibly cool thing I like about Eastern beliefs about dragons is the idea that dragon bones were dug up and ground down to be used in medicine.
Yes, you alluded to this on Monday's episode. It's a very evocative and fairly old idea, isn't it?
Well, our records of this practice date from around 300 BC, so during the European Iron Age. And at this time, in China in particular, people were digging up bones said to be dragon bones and using them in medicine. And the theory goes that often these were dinosaur fossils, but it's also believed that these might have just been other animal bones, particularly bones of horses and similar creatures, which people just billed as small dragons.
And just to connect some of this together, how likely was it that ancient ideas of dragons from the Far East made their way across to the Middle East and ancient Mesopotamia, Egypt, and then the Mediterranean?
Well, we know that from the 10th millennium BC, so over 12,000 years ago, we had the beginnings of what was later called the Silk Road. This was the trade route we know stretched from what is now China into the Middle East and into Africa. And the earliest records of this trade is in things like obsidian, spices, and precious stones.
It's such a long time ago.
It's mind-boggling. And of course, as time went on and maritime trade, so sea trade, developed, we get tons of different goods moving around between Greece and Rome through the Red Sea to India and China and beyond. The ancient Egyptians wrote quite a bit about this, as did a lot of other cultures along the Silk Road route.
So it's completely reasonable to think ideas were spreading along these trade routes, along with things like food and dyes and animals.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we know from Barrow tombs in England that trade for tin in particular made Cornwall and the southwest of England hugely important trade destinations. Discoveries like the Amesbury Archer, for example, he dates from around 2300 BC and was found near Stonehenge.
We went to see him the other day and his grave goods, yep. All 100 or so pieces they found buried with him.
We did. And amongst grave goods like those, you find things like archers' wrist guards, gold, silver, and other precious stones and so on that have come from Egypt or the Caucasus Mountains, which, you know, stretch from Europe into Asia. The theory is people would come to Stonehenge from far off lands to trade for tin.
Well, the Amesbury Archer himself was born in the Alps, wasn't he?
Yeah, it seems so. Meaning there's little doubt, honestly, that ideas of dragons were very much moving around through the ancient world before we have a written record. And so when you start to get our first stories of dragons, like Muskusu and Apep, it's important to understand that considering trade with China, these kinds of myths of serpentine creatures had most certainly been in the human cultural mix for thousands of years already.
That's absolutely mind-blowing.
It's incredibly cool, isn't it? But that ain't the half of it, although we have reached our halfway point. But we'll be back with more on Norse and later concepts of dragons and much more right after this.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Okay, Martin, so you've taken us right back to the earliest records we have of dragons. But I'm guessing that from the Greeks and Romans, we get a bit of an accelerated development of our concept of dragons.
We do, or at least we get an increased number of references to them in writing. Because in ancient Egypt, for example, we get other dragons and dragon-like demons like Wajet, the green dragon, who's a winged snake. She starts cropping up about 3,000 years ago. And around the same time, you also get stories of myths which echo one another really closely, following the template of the story of Marduk subduing Muskusu.
I mean, of those, I'm probably most familiar with the story of Apollo slaying Python,
sure.
Which is quite famous,
yeah.
And of course is where we get the term Python from those very big snakes found in the tropics.
Yeah, named in 1803 by a French explorer, as you say, after the ancient Greek myth. But in terms of that story, you get loads of variations of much the same thing. For example, the story of the Arcadian and Syrian god Hadad, or Baal, defeating the dragon Lotan, or Temtem, the Hittite god Tarhunts defeating the dragon Ilyanka, the Hebrew god Yahweh defeating Leviathan, Zeus defeating the hundred-headed god Typhon, Heracles, or Hercules, defeating the dragon Ladon, and then much later, the tale of Thor's duel with the great dragon Jormungandr.
Wow, okay, so it seems like there's a real proliferation of dragon stories from the Bronze Age.
Yeah, there really is. And I'm not expecting the average person to know who half of these deities are. Some of them probably sound quite obscure, and there is still a bit of an academic bun fight about where the original version came from, which then proliferated all through the Middle East and East Africa and around the Mediterranean. But one central thread that links a lot of them together is that, for the most part, they're sky gods, so gods of the sun or storms or thunder and lightning, and the dragons they deal with are almost always sea creatures or dragons that have come out of the sea.
And so there's quite a bit of symbolism there, isn't there, with this idea of the sky having dominance and superiority over the oceans.
Yeah, the general analogue is intended to be about order, the sky conquering chaos, the oceans. And you can take that a step further to talk about the sky symbolising enlightenment and the profound, literally being above, and the ocean representing the obscure and the mysterious and what's literally below. To pick a prominent example, the Hebrew Bible, which is starting to come together around 500 BC, so over 2,500 years ago, that contains the story of Yahweh's defeat of Leviathan. And Leviathan, as we understand the idea now, is said to be a female dragon, a sea monster created at the dawn of time, along with Behemoth, a male chaos beast who's a bit more like a vast hippopotamus.
Very much like the term chaos beast.
Yes, good, isn't it?
And honestly, when you're researching podcast episodes or writing an academic essay, I think it would be an accurate description of you.
Okay, well, I'll take that gladly. One for the business card.
Martin Vaughs, chaos beast.
Email me at 3ravenspodcast@gmail.com. Anyway, in the early pieces of the Hebrew Bible, which eventually get codified and rewritten and reinterpreted by all three of the major Abrahamic religions over time, Behemoth represents the dry earth and deserts, while Leviathan represents the sea.
And it's said that at the end of time, Leviathan and Behemoth will fight.
That's right. So at the end of time, as described in the Book of Revelations and elsewhere, the land and the sea will be at war, basically. But in terms of Leviathan specifically, she's supposed to be 300 miles long, she can breathe fire, and, looping back to where we started, she's described as having bright, flashing, dazzling eyes.
And so Yahweh, God, defeats Leviathan as part of the creation myth.
Well, that's quite confusing, because there are conflicting versions. But the long and the short of it is, there are originally two Leviathans and two Behemoths, each having a male and female. And the general idea is that Yahweh, who created them in the first place, kills one of each to stop them reproducing. And as with almost all of these myths and legends, the more closely you look at them, the more unlike one another they become, even if the broad stroke ideas are the same.
And then we get later versions of these stories, like Hercules fighting the dragon Ladon,
who's the offspring of Typhon, who Zeus already beat up.
And as mentioned, Apollo fighting Python,
who was, like Typhon, the offspring of the Titans Gaia and Tartarus. Although Python was said to live coiled up in the world's navel beneath the oracle at Delphi.
Oh no, come on. A dragon in your belly button. Gaia, bathe yourself regularly. Self-care. Anyway, so yeah. I can see what you mean in that really, on a symbolic level, yeah, these are stories about a civilizing power, so a god, the sky, or some sort of deific layer down of rules, subduing some sort of primordial creature representing disorder.
That's absolutely right. And so baked into the most ancient dragon myths, you have this idea of dragons being an enemy to order. And when it comes back to our friends the Normans again, it's the same idea. You have all these stories of Norman knights coming along and subduing or defeating chaos.
That's much like with the St. George and the dragon story. You've got this notion of dragons also coming to serve as stand-ins for paganism or old religions and cultures.
Yes.
And of course, the devil.
Well, most definitely. You can see that idea in a lot of those early stories where Ladon, for example, is this serpentine dragon who lives in the boughs of the tree that bears the golden apples. So a hint at the Garden of Eden there. Similarly, Leviathan was reframed by early Christians to become a devilish creature interchangeable with the devil. And then you have something like the Nidhoggur in Norse mythology, which eats at the roots of Yggdrasil, the world tree. Again, a bit of a tree of knowledge analogue. And Nidhoggur, of course, is the dragon responsible for bringing all suffering into the lives of the creatures that live in the world tree.
And I'm wondering, because you mentioned Leviathan breathes fire.
Yeah.
Do lots of these early mythical dragons breathe fire?
No, not really early on. I mean, the Lernaean Hydra, for example, in that myth, of course, each head of the Hydra, once cut off, regrows. So there's something monstrous there for sure. It's a bit like a fire spreading and growing and has this idea of perhaps the Hydra being unkillable because it grows back like a blaze. And in the end, the Hydra is defeated because each wound is cauterized, burned, closed, so it can't return. As for fire-breathing dragons, that idea really starts with Leviathan. And from there, it proliferates and you get a whole bunch of fire-breathing dragons being written about.
Such as?
Well, I mentioned Jormungandr before. In Norse mythology, Jormungandr is a child of the trickster god Loki and a female jotun, so a giantess, called Angerboda. They also bear Fenrir, but that's a whole other story. In terms of Jormungandr, he's an Ouroboros, so a specific kind of dragon, one which bites its own tail.
A classic early symbol for infinity and the circle of life. Mm. The very first one, I believe, was found on the tomb of Tutankhamun.
Indeed, on King Tut's golden shrine, which was constructed around 1300 BC. And the Ouroboros crops up in lots and lots of places, but it's said that, like Apep, Jormungandr is wrapped right round the world biting his tail. It's then said that at Ragnarok, the end of the world, Jormungandr will wake up, release his bite, and become this fire-breathing devastator who Thor will ultimately have to defeat.
A sky god quelling chaos yet again.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, you can see the connection there to the end of the world and Leviathan. There's a definite echo to a lot of these dragon stories.
Yeah, quite right. But it's worth saying that the Eddas and Norse mythology, all that stuff is written down quite a long time after the very first reference to a fire-breathing dragon in a work of pure literature. That first reference, of course, being in Beowulf.
Ah, Beowulf, the foundation stone of all English literature.
Indeed, it's the very first English text, which, as I'm sure everybody knows, isn't about English people and isn't set in England.
No, but it was written down by an English monk.
Well, we presume so. It was certainly written down in England and kept here. Still, for those unfamiliar with the story of Beowulf, we accept it as a Christianized story. So there were probably earlier versions, but the one we have is framed within a Christian viewpoint. And it's split into three symbolic parts, a trinity, if you will. The first is about the young Beowulf, a Norse hero, dueling with Grendel, this monstrous child of the biblical Cain, who represents envy and jealousy, and who's kind of Beowulf's dramatic foil, the youthful representative of evil to Beowulf as the youthful representative of fallible but good human beings.
After which Beowulf then has to deal with and overcome Grendel's mother, who represents sins of lust and desire. And that battle is symbolic of Beowulf entering manhood.
Indeed. And then we have the final part, where we skip forward 50 years to when old man Beowulf has to battle a dragon. And like with Grendel and Grendel's mother, the dragon in Beowulf is also a kind of mirror to the moral issues Beowulf is facing at that stage of his life.
Well, in particular, the dragon guards this huge hoard of gold. And because one of Beowulf's slaves steals a single silver cup from his huge hoard of treasure, the dragon wreaks havoc on Beowulf's whole kingdom.
Yeah, and in going to fight the dragon, Beowulf is kind of resigned to the idea that he's going to die. You can view Beowulf as a kind of moralizing text fitting into Christian Stoic notions of morality, with these three parts of Beowulf's life fitting into the Aristotelian model of love. That is that you have three forms of love: filial love and friendship, so for a brother, erotic love and desire, and agape, sacrificial love.
And the idea of agape is that in order to love yourself or others, you have to give of yourself, sacrifice parts of yourself, or perhaps your whole self, for the good of others.
Yeah, that's right. In modern life, we're quite lazy about this idea. We often think of charity as giving what we have going spare. But in Stoic and Christian philosophy, the idea of agape is linked to giving things that hurt to give. So losing an arm for someone, or giving away wealth to those in need to put yourself in need. Or, inspired by the general Marcus Aurelius, who's really the first to articulate these ideas, give your life for a cause, to give both that cause and your life meaning.
And the big example of this in Christianity is the idea of God's sacrifice of his only son and himself in the crucifixion.
Yeah, exactly. And so, in Beowulf, it's written into the text that the hero, Beowulf, knows this duel with greed and evil and destruction and revenge, all these negative qualities as represented by this dragon, will be his own undoing. And there's no real victory coming to Beowulf in his lifetime because of it. But the point is that in killing the dragon and himself simultaneously, so dying in the fight, Beowulf makes the world a better place for his people and for everyone who comes afterwards. And though it's not explicit in the text, we can presume from a Christian perspective that he also earns his way into heaven.
And so the monk who wrote Beowulf down is essentially integrating a previously pagan story into Christian tradition, saying, look, our culture and your culture are actually the same. Look at the lessons in your own story.
Yeah, quite right.
And so from what you've said already, what with Ladon and the golden apples, or dragons fiercely defending territory and so on in earlier myths, it's not exactly new that the dragon in Beowulf is this kind of avaricious creature.
No.
But I think I'm right in saying that Beowulf's fight with the dragon in that poem is genuinely the first example of a fight against a dragon in world literature.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we have myths before, often shown in art, and we can certainly consider some of that to be literature. But in pure and technical terms, Beowulf lays down the template that's then followed by the likes of Tolkien and every other fantasy writer ever since.
Not to say that there's a huge gap where nothing happens between Beowulf and Tolkien, though.
Goodness, no, not at all. But Beowulf is, we should say, really, really old. It's thought to have been written between the year 700 and 750, and it's about kings and people from the 6th century, so the 500s.
That is really wild, isn't it, when you think about it?
It is, considering Christianity was only really starting to coalesce in the 300s. But still, if we jump forward to the 12th and 13th centuries, we start to get a whole bunch of dragon stories, including in tales we later find in the Mabinogion.
Well, I'm familiar with the story, which is developed by Geoffrey of Monmouth, our old pal, which starts with our other old pal, Nennius, in his Historia Brittonum.
Yes.
And in that story, Vortigern, king of the Britons, orders a boy called Emrys to dig up two dragons who are fighting below the earth. These turn out to be the white dragon of the Anglo-Saxons and the red dragon of the Britons, or the red dragon of Wales, as some see it, with the red dragon winning that fight.
Yeah, Vortigern wants to build a castle, but he can't because these dragons keep fighting underground and making the earth quake.
And that's 9th century, isn't it?
Yeah, Nennius is writing in the 9th century. In terms of the sections of the Mabinogion, we think parts of them date from the 7th to 9th century, but the earliest copies we have date from the 12th and 13th century. And in those texts, later translated and smoothed out into the Mabinogion, you have the tale of King Clud and King Clefellus, the kings of Britain and France, who are said to be brothers. And in that story, as you mentioned, told by the ever-reliable Geoffrey of Monmouth, Britain is being troubled by these two dueling dragons, so Clud buries them beneath Oxford.
And so the end of that story is what Nennius wrote about. Geoffrey of Monmouth gives us a start.
Yeah.
So the only versions of the beginning of the story come from later texts.
That's right. But still, again, in these stories, the dragons represent chaos and disorder, which needs to be resolved. Likewise, in the Volsunga saga and the Elder Edda, you get stories like that of Fafnir, a greedy dwarf who, through his greed, becomes morally corrupted. He steals treasure, kills his father, and turns into a dragon, after which he's killed by Sigurd, or Siegfried, as he's known in some versions. That one dates from the 11th century.
Again, though, you can see the connection between devilish and sinful behaviour and Fafnir's transformation, can't you?
Yeah, you can.
It seems the notion is that increasingly, as time goes on, you have more and more stories where chaotic, evil and sinful behaviour becomes symbolic of the devil, embodied by dragons.
Mm.
And then you have virtuous heroes, normally Christian ones in European folklore, who come along and slay them.
Yeah, precisely. You get loads and loads of these tales, far too many for me to list, and they fit into this broader, perhaps dark age, certainly medieval drive towards ideas of chivalry and Christian behaviour.
Well, we were talking about Sutton Hoo in your Suffolk episode, and perfect example there. Radwald's grave goods have dragons in them.
Yes.
Vikings had dragons in loads of their art, on the boats, on figureheads. And so there is a link there between paganism and savagery in warfare and belief butting up against this new Christian culture.
And because a lot of these ideas of virtuous behaviour and Christian love and so on come out of texts communicated in Latin and Romantic languages, not least Roman Catholicism, you therefore get this idea of romanticism and romantic heroes, these brave questing knights embarking out from civilization, often quite Norman-style castle keeps and churches, to strike out and overcome devilish dragons terrorising the chaotic wilds.
I'm going out on a bit of a limb here. If you connect that idea to stories like those found in Nennius and the Mabinogion, and in Geoffrey of Monmouth, of course,
Yeah. You
can also see tales of dragon slaying as a kind of, well, imperialism, I guess.
Yeah, you definitely can. On the Local Legends interview I've recorded for Cornwall with the legendary Mike O'Connor, we talk about this in relation to giants. In particular, you get these representations of giants down in Cornwall around this time and in subsequent folk tales with all these brutish names and qualities. And really, those giants are likely to have been Cornish kings or tribes, or just the idea of pagan Cornish peoples, and the proliferation of these giant slaying stories that happens after the Norman invasion is arguably a way of telling the story of cultural takeover through the 11th to the 14th centuries.
Which links back to the classical examples you mentioned as well, because in a lot of those Bronze Age tales of sky gods conquering dragons, it's fair to read a lot of those stories as metaphors for one culture beating down and subjugating a neighbouring kingdom.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think those versions of dragon stories being about the conquest of, and to an extent the Christianisation of, wilder pagan cultures does only really start to shift as we move into the Renaissance.
Makes you feel a bit sad for dragons, though, doesn't it? Because they're kind of symbols of wildness in these texts.
Yeah.
Perhaps the wildness they represent isn't necessarily good. The qualities these dragons display are about greed and the death of cattle and people, and about hoarding wealth and selfishness and vengeance.
Yeah.
But if we consider the stories as propaganda, maybe the dragons get a bit of an unfair rap.
Well, it is often said, history is written by the victors.
This is true.
Mm.
Still, we were headed into the Renaissance, and you mentioned the Elizabethans and the cockatrice and the basilisk before. Is it around this time that we get the idea of the wyvern as something distinct from the dragon?
I mean, you mentioned how now we see wyverns or wyverns as distinct from dragons, with wyverns having these two front legs and a long tail, dragons having four legs, werums having no legs. And I wish that distinction had a bit more to it, but I'm going to shatter some illusions.
Oh no, is my categorisation wrong?
Well, I don't think so in the modern day, but if we look back a little bit, the word wyvern comes again from French and has a very similar root word meaning viper.
Oh, so wyvern's just another word for snake or serpent.
Yep, wivre, which is the original word. It later became weeper and then viper. The term wivre or wivren actually crops up before the word dragon does in England, but it means the same thing, and the two terms were completely interchangeable in reference to snakes.
Oh, what?
Yep, this is happening in the 14th century into the 15th century. So in various texts, it's translated both ways, including about the Leviathan in the Bible, for example. And widom is from the same root word wivra, meaning viper or snake, only it's the Germanic cousin. And it's then in the 16th century that we in England start to distinguish between a dragon, a wivern, and a widom. And we do this because of heraldry.
Hold on, because of heraldry.
Yeah, that's right. In essence, every coat of arms in England is not only drawn, but also described with those records kept in the English court. Similar happens in the French court too, with lines between who's in control of Northern Europe, of course, being quite lively at times. Still, to stop one family with one type of dragon and, let's say, a yellow and red flag getting confused with another, they start to distinguish them by the number of legs. So some become wyverns, and those are more associated with Brittonic families, including around Wales, and some become dragons, more associated with England, because those dragons look a bit more lion-like. But all of that really is about the crown making money, a bit like buying a copyright or something similar.
That's crazy. Who would have thought it would be something that cynical?
Yeah, it's quite strange, isn't it? But my point is, you're not wrong in your characterization of this system of classification for dragons. Only by Three Ravens standards, it's only been happening for 500 years, so it's a very modern development.
And heraldry aside, I think it's useful to be clear in how we distinguish one form of dragon from another, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you also get lindworms, don't you, which are their own sort of thing.
Yeah, so the lindworm is very much a German and Eastern European idea. These kinds of myths and legends start appearing in the late 16th, early 17th century, and are very popular in the 19th century. They do have French and English precedence in a way, because lindworm stories are normally about hidden identity.
Well, to start with, what does the lint in lindworm mean?
Well, it means flexible or bendy or agile.
So a lindworm is just a bendy serpent.
Yeah, kind of. But this is where the German language reveals a bit of its beauty, in that this bendiness, this flexibility, isn't just because serpents are long and wriggle and coil around things, but rather almost all lindworm stories are about people, often princes, sometimes princesses, who have been transformed, so bent or flexed, into the monstrous shape of a dragon.
And we also, of course, get tales of those who are hiding the fact they're a dragon or part snake, like in the Melusine story.
Yeah, or your Mermaid of Xena story from our third ever episode. But perhaps the most general way of thinking of lindworm tales is as something like Beauty and the Beast, where you have a noble character transformed into a wild or sinful or dangerous creature, a devilish version of themselves, we might say. And then through the purifying influence of someone, normally a true love's kiss from a princess, or perhaps the prowess of a questing knight with their symbolic sword thrusting away, the curse of the lindworm is undone, meaning the prior sin is exorcised and the innocent noble character return to their original form.
And that links once again back to an idea we were talking about right at the start of the episode, with dragons serving as a kind of catalyst for change, turning people from one thing, healthy human beings, into other things, often stone or ash or some other sort of base matter.
Which is quite significant, I think, when you read into the metaphor, because often we see, like in the case of Fafnir, this dwarf transformed into a dragon by greed, that the dragon in this mix always represents some sort of base matter, something low and sinful and devilish. And that corruption is something the dragon can then spread like a contagion.
And you see that idea co-opted by organisations like the Ku Klux Klan, for example.
Yes, true.
Where
yeah.
chapters of that heinous organisation call themselves dragons.
Yes.
And in folklore, these dragons will continue to spread their contagion unless purified or subdued one way or another, though usually through some kind of pseudo-Christian act of virtue.
Well, exactly. And in the Elizabethan era, you get one of the big famous examples of this in Edmund Spenser's The Faerie Queen, this doorstopper of an epic poem, which is kind of an extended metaphor about England at the time. And in that poem, you have this noble Arthurian knight, Red Cross, who overcomes comes this sinful dragon stabbing it with a lance.
And the Fairy Queen, as a work, was supposed to, among other things, instruct the people of Tudor England about how to live a virtuous life. Mm. So Red Cross and his journey is very much about overcoming sin to save Lady Una, who he then marries.
Yeah, quite right. And so you have, after the Fairy Queen, a kind of decoupling of this necessary or perhaps integral idea of imperialism within dragon stories. And really, through the Enlightenment, you move into this period where, for William Blake and people like him, they are useful as a figure for Satan. For Keats and people like him, they become a symbol of fear. And then for the Victorians, during the folk revival, you get a whole load of dragons cropping up again, by which time it's sort of just for the fun of it, in a way.
Well, Tennyson writes a whole load of Arthurian poems with dragons in. Mm. And you spoke about the arts and crafts movement in your local legends interview with Kirsty Hartsiotis last Saturday. But with the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood and all those writers and painters, you get a pivot back towards classical myths and legends again, don't you?
Yeah, most definitely. Lots of dragons, Weddams, ancient Greek monsters and legends. And this is all kind of in response to the feeling that post-industrial revolution, things are going wrong with society. So people start to look back with rose-tinted glasses to times they perceived as better. And you get the first attempts being made to more systematically record English folktales at the time, and that revives interest in a lot of the older dragon stories and ballads, like those from across north of England with all their worm and dragon legends roaring back into the public consciousness.
Which in turn also leads into Lewis Carroll and the Jabberwocky, Tales of Knuckers, and in due course, Tolkien, who published The Hobbit in, what, 1940?
1937. And it's fair to say that dragons had been burbling away in the public consciousness before then. A lot of hill figures had been carved during the 19th and early 20th century. Early monuments had been erected, statues made. It's not like dragons were ever completely out of fashion. But then, after The Hobbit and then The Lord of the Rings, you get this more or less whole new genre of fantasy fiction, which absolutely explodes interest in dragons. After which, in a way, you can't move for the damn things.
And I'm guessing it's after that we move into this phase of people going, well, blue dragons are water dragons, and red dragons are fire dragons, and all of that jazz.
Well, Dungeons and Dragons, again, has a huge amount to answer for there, as do an increasing number of video games, which all bring myths and legends into people's homes in new ways. And so, you know, the Final Fantasy series launches in 1987, and although it has precursors, in that you get this huge celebration of different mythical traditions. So Bahamut, the Arabic take on Leviathan, becomes this huge dragon, and Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent of Aztec mythology, becomes another form of dragon. And suddenly it's as if all these different versions of demons or gods or serpents from all these diverse cultural traditions are all up for reinterpretation as quite similar forms of what we think of as a dragon.
And it isn't just video games, of course, because in the same period we have comics and TV shows and films, as well as loads of books all containing innumerable versions of dragons. But certainly to me, it feels a bit like maybe we've lost a lot of the symbolism that you've been talking about, which made dragons so interesting to begin with.
I mean, it's a sad world if we're finding ourselves bored of dragons, but my worry really is that it feels like dragons are kind of a byword for cool, powerful fantasy creature. And so they serve as a way for people to sort of reach for the 11 out of 10 mythical monster in a story, whatever form that story takes. With a danger being that, in a way, it's in their specificity that dragons have the most charm.
I can see that. I mean, a dragon wrapped all the way around the world causing earthquakes is something else to Matt Smith riding a dragon into battle on HBO.
Yeah, completely. But to take an example I haven't touched on. In Australian Aboriginal culture, which is by no means homogenous, but still, the general idea in Australian Aboriginal culture is that all of creation was made by the great rainbow serpent. And the rainbow serpent is a dragon. Again, she came out of the sea, making land for the Aboriginal peoples to live on and creating life and bringing rain. In some traditions, she's also a hermaphrodite, but she's also a kind of sky god and is most often witnessed in rainbows.
What? So rainbows are seen as the rainbow serpent?
Yep. When you see a rainbow, that's because in Aboriginal belief, or the oral cultural tradition known as the dreaming or dream time, which holds all of Aboriginal lore, the rainbow symbolizes that the rainbow serpent is happy and busy up in the sky making good things happen. But, and this is an interesting part of it for me, it's also said that if people behave badly and do things that upset the rainbow serpent, who has about 40 different names, but the point is, if you make her angry, she'll show her anger in bad weather and storms.
So she's a dragon that kind of exists outside of the Christian European tradition.
Oh, yeah.
She sort of fulfills a lot of roles at once.
Yeah, and there are tons of stories about the rainbow serpent, loads of myths about the things she does or has done and people she's interacted with. And there are, of course, lots of myths from other cultures I've not touched on during this episode, which have similarities, especially in Japan and parts of South America. But I would really recommend, if you're interested in dragons, do go and read about the rainbow serpent, because she's super culturally important to Aboriginal Australians, and she serves as a useful example to shake us out of this post-medieval idea of what dragons are meant to represent.
Well, I will do exactly that. And thank you so much, Martin. That was suitably epic.
I mean, I realise it's a lot longer than most of my Three Ravens Bestiary episodes, but if you're talking about dragons, you kind of have to go for it, don't you?
You do. And what will we be talking about on next month's episode of the Three Ravens Bestiary?
Next month, again, based on listener requests, we're going to be talking about goblins. So, Eleanor, prepare for lots of books to be opened and left on all the surfaces in our study, and for me to go slightly mad as I venture down into goblin caves to search for answers.
Chaos beast.
Guilty as charged, I guess. Oh, and just to finish, based on what we've talked about, how big do you think a dragon should be? We've got, you know, the complete scale from 25,000 miles, the circumference of the world, down to 16 yards. I mean, of course, we also get descriptions of smaller dragons, bird-sized dragons, and creatures like the Jaculus, little flying wormy ones. But how big or how large do you think a dragon should be?
About the size of a house.
About the size of a house.
Unless it's a baby.
Oh, yeah, baby dragon.
Baby dragons should be smaller.
That would be very painful to lay that egg, wouldn't it? Yeah, like a horse size if it's a
baby. Horse size for a baby, house size if it's a grown-up.
Excellent. Can't say fairer than that. And as always, dear listener, if you have 5 minutes, do please pop a review for The Three Ravens on wherever you listen. And if you can, do write us a full review. We will read it out.
And please share the podcast, tell your friends, and join the fun and gronk away with the rest of the Three Ravens community on social media via facebook.com/Three Ravens Podcast, Instagram at Three Ravens Podcast, and X via Three Ravens Pod.
And if you're on X or Twitter, do also consider joining in with hashtag Froki Friday. Each Friday I run it at Froki Friday, and our theme tomorrow is nature gods and summer spirits.
To support the podcast and unlock tons of exclusive content, including our brand new Three Ravens newsletter, which came out yesterday, please sign up to our Patreon for $3 a month or $6 a month at patreon.com/Three Ravens Podcast, and email us your 3,000 word ghost stories to threeravenspodcast@gmail.com.
Likewise, please keep sending in your local lore, folkloric facts, and curious nuggets of knowledge to that same address, threeravenspodcast@gmail.com. And do please check out this month's Three Ravens Book Club pick, Song of the Huntress by Lucy Holland.
We will be back on Monday when Martin is taking us to Cornwall and telling his new take on The Sword in the Stone.
Yep.
But before then, this Saturday's Local Legends interview will see Martin chatting with podcaster and folklore content creator Fairy Folk, and that comes out on Saturday.
Until then, dearest Ravens, while our dragon's gone to hide in a dark place, that way, we'll go this way.
And remember, don't whistle till you're out of the woods. Our theme song is the traditional folk ballad Three Ravens, performed by Eleanor Conlon and Ben Harbour. And our logo is by Ollie James Dare.
The Three Ravens podcast is a Rust and Stardust production, written and produced by me, Martin Vaux. Thanks for listening.
God send every gentleman such hounds, such hawks, such leemen, with a down, derry, 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 down, down.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.